Hey, it's Jose Galison. You're watching No Way Jose. You can find me on the No Way Jose YouTube channel, all the major auto podcatchers and Odyssey as well. Today, my guest is Matthew Gilman. We're continuing our series on the Duncan Lemp book he wrote, The Crash of the Night, The Assassination of Duncan Lemp. This may be the last episode. We'll see. I think it may actually be. But just to remind you guys how this works, if you're watching the 22nd, you are watching the live stream. What happens is almost immediately after I will take it down and it'll put up about roughly a week or so up later publicly. So you either got to catch the live stream or you got to wait. If you want to have access in the meantime, you need a patron at patreon.com. Just Noe Jose 2020. The lowest level is $2. The highest level is 20, and 20 is my sponsors. $2 gets you the access to it in the meantime, though. So that's all you're really going to do is the $2. But there's different levels of 5, 10, 20. So, and they all have different perks. But the $20 levels of sponsors, and my sponsors are Mikkel Thorpe of the Expat Money Show. If you want to get the hell out of Dodge, move to a different country, passports, I know, or if you want to have dual citizenship, stuff like that, he's your guy. It's a podcast. He also does it as a business, the Expat Money Show. I also have Jeremy, who has an Etsy shop at etsy.com/shop/raisingliberty. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeremy Rhymes. Also have Toad. He's my co-host on Tower Power Hour, so go check out that show for sure. Yeah, it's mostly on Odyssey, but there is a YouTube as well. But I suggest going to Odyssey if you can. We only keep the past few episodes up on YouTube, and then the whole all the episodes go up on Odyssey. So if you want to see any of the good stuff, like our Shoe on Head episode or multiple Dave Smiths, we've got some other big names I'm not thinking of right now. And then just other some good episodes that were just us and the boys. Highly suggest checking it out. That's Toad at @TPH_Toad on Twitter if you want to follow him there. Also, Top Lobster, toplobster.com. You're supposed to say at checkout for 10% off. He has my merch. He does a bunch of other shows' merch. So if you want to get No Way Jose merch, that's the place to do it. I suggest doing that. He also has a lot of other good stuff in there as well that's not show merch. But yeah, let's go ahead and get Matthew in here and get into it. Hey, what's up, man?
Not much. How you been?
Good, good. I saw you on the Libertarian Institute the other day with Keith Knight. That was pretty dope. So I suggest people, if you want to get what we're doing in a like 30-minute condensed version, if you don't want to go or read the book, I guess that's the place to do it, you know? So, it was a good interview though. I enjoyed it. I like Keith and I like you obviously. So, and I'm glad that they did that. That was cool. Yeah. So, you ready to get into it, man?
Yeah.
Let's start off with, let's talk about crypto, because that was a big part of Duncan. Let's talk about what his involvement in crypto was. Actually, start off with, once again, this is series I'm kind of trying maybe evergreen. I know most of my audience probably already knows what crypto is and stuff like that, but let's just do a quick refresher on like what is crypto, why is it a threat in the government, and then we'll get into Duncan's involvement. Just a real crash course, not too long, because like I said, most of my audience already knows, but you never know when new people might be showing up on this. And I mean, you know, you never know. I mean, I'm definitely not very I know crypto theoretically. I don't have any. I'm awful when it comes to tech stuff. I need to do that. So I mean, I guess there's probably people out there who don't. So if you don't mind, you want to do a quick kind of what is crypto, and then like, you know, its kind of role in relation to the government.
Yeah. Well, you're probably more familiar with it than I am. I still don't fully grasp the idea of crypto. For me, I like having something tangible that I can hold in my hand that has value. So the idea of a digital currency doesn't really click in my head, but for whatever reason, it does for several other people. But it's a digital form of currency, especially with Bitcoin. Bitcoin seems to be the primary one, although there's also Deutsche and other forms of coins. There, Deutsche has a, it's another, it's like a token.
The Dogecoin, the D-O-G-E.
Like there's tokens, there's coins, there's all these different forms, and they have different, each term has a different meaning behind it. But when it comes to cryptocurrency, they're all under that same category. But it's not created by a government or a central bank or a Federal Reserve. It's individuals outside of that system who create this currency, which develops its own value according to the people who want to use it. So the more people who want to use it, the higher the value goes. With Bitcoin, there's a set number of Bitcoin, and there's never going to be any more.
Real quick, I did want to emphasize, because you brought up the other coins, that is the major, one of the major differentiations between it and some of the other ones. I think some of the other crypto have limited as well, but some don't. A lot of people just see crypto as like all the same. A lot of them are different. Once again, like I said, I don't really have any crypto, mostly just because I'm a tech idiot. In theory, I like the concept of it. It daunts me to try to get into it tech-wise. I'm kind of like an old man in that way, but theoretically, I like the concept of it. But yes, they are different. I know that's the big thing with Doge. I think they can just kind of make more, I believe. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's why a lot of people are kind of like, a lot of people will trade in what's called, they call them shit coins a lot of times. So they'll trade in them to, you know, kind of flip, kind of just to make money, more of a, like an investment thing, because then they'll go up in value. But a lot of crypto people know they are in the end kind of long-term bad investments, but you can kind of make short-term gains here and there. So, but yeah. Didn't mean to cut you off. Go on.
The other thing with Bitcoin is, because there's a finite number, there are coins that have been lost over the years. There was the case of the guy who threw away a hard drive and had his, I forget how many digits it is, but it's the passcode for his coins. Then he realized years later that this thing was worth millions of dollars now, and he actually was trying to get the dump to look in the area that his hard drive would have been at the time when it was thrown into the dump. So the more coins that disappear, the less there are, which means that the ones that are still in use have a higher value. So with Duncan, he was very interested in Bitcoin. It sounded like it was for several reasons. One was the independence of the individual to have some form of currency outside of government, to be able to purchase things without any tracking or tracing. It was digital. It was high tech. He was a very techie guy, a programmer. So you come up with some form of currency that involves what you're interested in. You're going to it's going to pique your interest. He did a couple interviews. They're still available on YouTube, where he was talking about Binance, which is a form of cryptocurrency trading. It's like a trading system that's online. And
it's an exchange. It might be an exchange, I believe. I don't know.
Yeah.
That sounds familiar, but I'm not entirely sure.
It's come up quite a bit with this,
FTX?
FTX, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, they were supposed to be an alternative to this, and obviously was kind of a bad idea for anybody who used it. He was interested in improving Binance for crypto. The downside that I found with Bitcoin was the fact that every transaction was added to that Bitcoin. So if you bought Bitcoin, whatever it is that you bought would have every transaction used on that Bitcoin, that amount. So anybody could go back and see that, 5 years ago, so-and-so bought something online on eBay or this place or that place, or there was a transaction privately amongst two people, and you would know the information behind that. So that's security wise, I never understood that aspect of Bitcoin, because all it would take would be some type of the government to become interested enough to say, like, we want to invest in Bitcoin. And because now they're talking about with FTX that they want to regulate Bitcoin. Well, all they'd have to do is take one of these bills, put a couple billion dollars into it, and they could buy virtually all the Bitcoin that's out there and then recirculate it, and they would have the access to all that information. They would be able to look at that Bitcoin and see what was purchased beforehand, what kind of transactions were taxable. So I never really understood that when it came to Bitcoin, but why it was a threat to the government is the fact that it's a form of currency. They don't know what's out there. They don't know how it's being used. They can't monitor the transactions. I guess technically they could with all the information that they are tracking online, but it just makes everything more difficult. It's not like you go through an airport and they know how much money is in your suitcase or what you have to claim, right? You have your cell phone, you've got your numbers, you've got an account somewhere else. I don't know exactly how it works. I'm guessing like it's not on your phone, but yeah, when it comes to Bitcoin, they have no idea like how much you have, where it's at, how you're using it. It's kind of a nightmare for them, especially when they like to control people the way that they do.
Yeah, I don't know the details of how it works with the tracking. I know they can. I don't think it's particularly easy, if I recall. I believe, because I think the idea of how it's tracked is there's like some sort of ledger, and I think that's more of the purpose so that they can keep track of itself in a certain way. That way, you know where all the Bitcoin is, kind of deal. But I don't think it's like super easy. I mean, yes, I think they obviously are able to track what's done where, but I don't think it's like the easiest thing. So I think it's like, it's way more difficult than just like your normal, like, you know, debit card transaction or some shit, you know, like, so, I mean, but once again, I'm no crypto guy. I would suggest people like, I don't know, maybe like a Vin Armani or a Sal Mayweather. There's definitely, Saifa Dean, I think is one dude. There's a lot of guys who are big into crypto. If that's something you want to delve into, for our purposes, it's probably enough digging because me and you don't really know what we're talking about a whole lot. I like the idea in theory. And I did want to touch on real quick because the big thing with like the government getting involved, I guess theoretically they could buy up a ton of Bitcoin, but I guess eventually it would recirculate back to other private actors and also government actors. The big threat, as we mentioned, stuff like Doge before, is stuff like that they can manipulate, they can add, because that's the big thing. If they ever got into Bitcoin, like even if they did try to take over the market share and just like have all of it and try to manipulate it, like they'd be trying to manipulate to destroy it, not to use it as like as a currency, because there's just not a feasible, because the big thing with our financial system is that they can print more money and they can manipulate the currency. And they, like you said, they could buy a bunch of it up and they can manipulate in that way. But that's like, that's just only like one trick out of, whereas with something like a fiat currency or like a Dogecoin or something, they can manipulate it far more. To their liking. So, because I mean, most people are concerned they're going to swap over to a crypto type of fiat system soon. Bitcoin doesn't really work well for that. And then I did real quick want to touch on the exchanges, because FTX did go down. I don't know about Binance, so I don't know the features of Binance. I've heard of it before vaguely. So I don't want to like shit on the memory of like Duncan if he was, you know, pushing that. I don't know the details of Binance, but I know something like FTX is the idea is it's essentially like a bank for crypto. Mm-hmm. And one of the perks of crypto is that you don't need a bank. Cause it's like, I know it's not your keys, not your crypto or some shit. I forget there's some term they use, but basically the idea is you can, have your own crypto and store it yourself. Like you can have your own wallet. But that's where it gets a little bit more difficult. And that's the daunting thing for me. Like I probably could go get on an exchange of some sort and it'd be a lot easier. It's a lot more user friendly. But now the issue is if you're trying to figure out the aspect of having your own like wallet and stuff, it's a little bit more difficult. And that's why All these exchanges come in, but then with that comes other issues, you know, as we saw with FTX, where they can manipulate stuff. Also, technically, same thing with the Canadian trucker protests. That was the big reason why they were able to fuck a lot of those guys over, is because their money was held on, their crypto was held on exchanges. Whereas had it been in their own wallet, like, I think they would have been able to possibly, the government might have been able to stop them from doing, I'm talking a little bit on my ass here, but I think the government would have been able to stop them from, like, you know, trading crypto, but they wouldn't have been able to, like, keep their crypto away kind of deal. I might be wrong, but I know the big thing with the Canadian was the fact that they were on exchanges. And so that's how they were able to be like, nope, that's not yours anymore. See ya. Like, because it kind of isn't. The same concept with a bank. It's like you saw the bank runs, what was it? I forget, was in the early 1900s or maybe mid 1900s, where like that's like A Wonderful Life, you know, like there's that one scene with the bank. That was the thing, is they were like, you know, manipulating the currency, and people came to get their lost trust in the bank, and they came to get their money out, and they're like, oh, well, sorry. Because it's like, it's not really yours. Like, you're giving it to me, giving it to this other entity, and people don't really read the dotted line or the little small text at the bottom of the little contracts or whatever, you know, like sort of not your money, kind of isn't. So, but all right, let's move on to guns. We've talked about guns a little bit before, you know, with Duncan. Let's touch on a little bit more, kind of like the aspects, like the details of his supposed crimes and that aspect, and some other things. I don't think we really touched too much on like the ghost gun aspect as well. So Leah, let's go ahead and dig into that. Skimming through the book real quick. What was the supposed crime that the Montgomery County was focused on with this raid? I believe we did touch on this before, but we're gonna go a little bit more into it here.
Yeah, so they initially got the warrant to go into the house and conduct this no-knock raid for a rifle that he owned. It was I believe it was an Israeli X90 style rifle. There's variations of it. He had a legal one. He had one that he bought in Maryland from a gun
Israeli
shop.
Israeli made IWI Tavor X95. So any gun nerds out there, that might mean something to you.
Sorry, I got the number wrong.
I only knew it because I looked it up real quick.
But yeah, so his was completely legal. He bought it legally, background check, cleared a background check. It was semi-auto, not a full auto. There was the question of the length of the barrel, because there's a stipulation in Maryland about what makes it an assault rifle, and apparently the length of the barrel is a determining factor. The Montgomery County Police was trying to claim that this gun was capable of being fired in full auto, which of course goes back to 1980s gun laws when it comes to owning automatic firearms. But this was the rifle that they got the warrant for. However, their investigation, even though Duncan was deceased after the raid or during the raid, their investigation continued, and they confiscated other firearms, a 3D printer, all of his computers, a notebook, two cell phones, and a drill press. And so with these items, they were putting together that he was planning to build 3D printed firearms and distribute them, either sell them or distribute them to other people. Of course, this was after the raid. Why they were still investigating this or coming up with reasons as to why the raid was justified doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me. It just sounds more like they're trying to cover their asses for what happened, as opposed to like saying that they had probable cause, because the rifle in question that they had the warrant for was completely legal on all accounts, other than They still claim that he had a felony as a minor, which means in the state of Maryland, he couldn't own any firearms until the age of 30. But again, he passed background checks repeatedly over and over again, which also means if he thinks and or knows that he can legally purchase these weapons, he can also legally make 3D printed firearms at home. And a ghost gun is where you print the receiver on a 3D printer, which is the one part of the weapon that will have a serial number on it, which this is the crazy part of the police argument, is that it means that there's no record of it and there's no registry. Well, for one, a registry for firearms by the federal government is illegal. The Supreme Court already said so. There's no reason for the government to have a registry of who owns what, which is why they have the credit cards doing that for them now. So, you know, that there's this big argument about, you know, ghost guns and how legal they are and they can't be traced, which they're not supposed to be able to trace these things anyways. But he did, from the report, he did make, I believe it was two pistols and a rifle from a 3D printer. They also stated in the report that building and making these firearms was not illegal in the state of Maryland, except unless you have a felony as a minor. So, you know, they're still pushing for that argument, which they've still not shown any proof that that is true. So again, like,
to clarify, they haven't even shown it to his lawyer or the family's lawyer. So it's not as simple as they haven't shown it to the public, because you can justify that as like, whatever, we don't need to know, or it's sealed or some bullshit. But to the fact that you wouldn't provide that to the I don't know if you'd call him the defense, but I guess the defense, the family's lawyer, when they're pursuing this legally. I mean, generally speaking, I mean, I don't know the details legally. Maybe there's some reason why they don't have to. But, you know, typically the standard is usually they're supposed to give the pertinent information to the other lawyer, the defense, mm-hmm. or whatever, you know.
Right. Yeah. There's the discovery aspect of a lawsuit where whatever evidence the other party has to be disclosed to the other side. So the fact that the prosecuting attorney who investigated the shooting right afterwards was able to access any records about Duncan Lum as a minor right away. And that was to say that the shooting was justified by the shooting officer. He was able to see it. And now that there's a lawsuit against the county for Duncan's death, murder, however it is you want to put it, now all of a sudden they're saying, well, the records of a minor are sealed. You can't have access to that. And then, you know, the lawyer comes back and says, no, I have the right to see this. And they're like, oh, well, we can't find it right now because of COVID. Now COVID's over, and as far as I can tell, she still hasn't had any access to these documents that allegedly exist, proving that Duncan wasn't allowed to own these firearms. So, yeah, there's and still there's also no evidence other than they collected these items from a house that shows any valid proof that Duncan was planning on creating like some type of libertarian militia factory of ghost guns for an army. You know, it's just it was a, in my opinion, it was just a fabrication in order to try to make him look more dangerous in their eyes. I just kept seeing like, that's not illegal. If I could go back to every estate sale I've ever been to and point out like, hey, they have a drill press, they must have been building ghost guns. You know, it's like, it's a common tool in almost every household that has a tool room or a tool shed. You know, most guys who tinker around and stuff like that have a drill press. It doesn't just have one function, but in course in law enforcement eyes, you know, they're going to try to connect it any way that they can.
I mean, to be fair, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if he was out there drilling third holes. But, you know, like, it's also, like, on you to prove that. Like, and they definitely did not. I mean, especially, you know, drilling third hole, a lot of people don't know that refers to, like, making it, like, taking a certain guns, you know, taking it from, like, a, you know, semi-automatic to automatic by, you know, augmenting the gun. You know, to bring that up, with the gun in question that he got is actually able to, you're able to get it in automatic, I think, in some areas. And you also, I believe that you probably can, alter it. I mean, I don't know the details of that gun. Maybe it's not a gun you can alter, but I think most you kind of can. Any gun that is typically, you know, may have an automatic function, you usually can, there's ways to change it to, you know, make it that way. But I thought it was interesting that the way the cops confirmed that it was actually, in fact, in their head, a automatic is they sent a picture to the manufacturer to have them to say, hey, could this be automatic or is this automatic? And they basically were like, yeah, it could be. But there was at the same time, there was a video on his Instagram that showed him shooting. And you can tell that, like, there was no automatic fire at that point, which, you know, if anyone's ever shot even a simple 3-round burst, it's pretty obvious, you know, the difference between someone just pulling the trigger real quick and an automatic, you know, it's very different. But yeah, I thought it was interesting. I also wanted to mention, I just thought it was funny. I don't know if they did this on purpose to make a point, but they made a point to mention that he had one of the many things they confiscated was a pistol with a bullet in the chamber. Like, oh no. And then, like, it's just like, really, honestly, if now, unless you have like kids running around or something, like if that, then I can understand, but really it's almost silly not to, like, if you're a big gun person, not to have a gun around that has one in the chamber. Like, yeah. Now if you have children in the house, yeah, that's a little bit different, but like in his house, there was no kids. So like, the idea that he wouldn't just have like a pistol on his nightstand with, you know, one in the chamber ready to go. I mean, anytime I carry, it's in the chamber ready to go. Like,
yeah. And the weird thing about that, and this is what I picked up from the report too, was they mentioned the pistol in the nightstand that had a bullet in the chamber, because they found another pistol somewhere else that with a loaded magazine, but it didn't have one in the chamber. So having said that, you have a gun that's ready to go, but their claim, their argument was that he had picked up the rifle, the one that wasn't loaded, didn't have one in the chamber. Like, that would be, he wouldn't reach for the pistol that's in the nightstand that's ready to go. He'd go for the rifle that's more cumbersome and he'd have to rack it first. They also stated that the magazine fell out of the rifle, which means that it wasn't even ready to go to be fired. It's just the whole story just doesn't make any sense. It's like, he's got a weapon that's ready to go. Obviously he put it there for that reason. Then he's got this other rifle, and they're so focused and concentrated on this rifle that they come up with this story that he raised it at the officers. They told him to put it down. They shoot him. He fell on the weapon. That's more evidence that he had it on him while he's bleeding to death because he was shot multiple times. They had to remove it from under his body. They put it on the bed and there's not a drop of blood on the weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is a little bit hard to believe. I know the thing that always comes back to me that fucks with me is the supposed testimony of Casey that he did fire in the one, but that was the one that was supposed to be sealed. It's very weird. Like, there's so much weirdness around that. And like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was just like a fog. Like, I mean, maybe it was one of those things where they misrepresented what she said. Like, maybe it was like maybe he could have, I'm not entirely sure type thing. Like, I don't know. I'd like to find out more about that for sure, because that aspect is weird. And, you know, when I talked to Casey in my show, she was adamant that she had basically never changed her story. And I'm definitely not trying to call her a liar at all. If anything, I'd be more leaning towards that either it was they straight up lied, or it was one of those factual but not truthful type things from the government, you know, where they're misrepresenting what she said, but technically it's true. Maybe it was, like I said, seated in like a, well, maybe, I'm not entirely sure, or something like that, you know. So that is one that really fucks with me. All right, let's move on to one of the guys you interviewed in this was Mike Dunn. And he had some stuff that came up, and this was stuff, stuff that he said was stuff that I've heard elsewhere about this, but it was never really all that confirmed, and we'll kind of get into that. But I want to kind of start out with who the hell Mike Dunn is, and then I would like you to address some of the possible Fed implications, because I do think it's important, because it, to some people that may denigrate his, you know, testimony, from what I know, I don't know. It doesn't really seem I don't know much about the guy, but the thing that people point to doesn't really seem to be that, you know, bulletproof of that, like, oh, he's a Fed. But, you know, I don't know. Yeah. And also the stuff that he says seems to be weird, that this would be like a Fed psyop that he's like, you know, pushing out to the world. Cause I mean, if anything, I don't think that'd be some stuff Feds want to get out, but, let's talk about him real quick. And then kind of what he revealed about what he thought Duncan was up to.
Okay, so Mike Dunn is a former leader of the Boogaloo Boys. There was a Vice documentary that was done about him. He was very involved in the Boogaloo, especially 2020, around that time, especially leading up to around the time that Duncan Lemp was shot and killed. He was starting his own militia called the Virginia Knights. Duncan was had made the website for that group. That was the start of their interactions. They started talking on Facebook and different groups, and then elsewhere online. Duncan worked in this project for him. There was from what I got out of Mike, there was a lot of interactions through various social media and off of that, between the two of them. They talked about a lot of things that they were interested in. But as for Mike, he's got an interesting history. He's a Marine who was medically discharged after a tour in Afghanistan at 19. He joined when he was 17, was already out of service at 19, went and started working with the Boogaloo Boys after that, the Virginia Knights. Was doing a lot of protesting when it came to 2A in Virginia, was arrested a few times over that. There was an incident where one of the guys affiliated with his group was trying to convince Mike that it was a good idea to bomb a hospital in order to start the Boog. And from what I learned about the Boogaloo Boys was that they were ready and prepared to fight in the Boog when it happened, but it was not their place to start it. That was for the government to do. So Mike turns this guy in, and right away people are saying that, oh, he's a Fed. He's a traitor to his own people. He'd turn his own guys in. What kind of person does this? Mike ends up leaving the Boogaloo Boys, and not long after that, he heads over to Ukraine. This was just right after Russia invaded, and he's been over there on and off a couple times in the last year. So that's kind of been his focus. There's some ideas and thoughts out there that he'll probably end up coming back to the Boogaloo. I don't know. It just seems like he's kind of focused on other things and trying to find his place as to what he wants to do. There was some criticism that he did work as a correction officer for a while, but again, he's former military. There's not much work in civilian life that translates from that kind of background. So a lot of former Army Marines, they end up going into things like law enforcement, corrections, security, things of that nature, which you know, if you're a libertarian slash anarchist, you have guys in your group that have certain backgrounds. There's only so much work that they can do with the experience that they have, and it's probably not going to align with a lot of the ideas that other people have. And I think that's kind of where Mike's getting stuck in the whole ordeal.
Yeah, I will say with the corrections thing, I've known a lot of people went corrections route, and I mean, I think a lot of people have the mentality of, like, you know, even as an anarchist, they're like, well, I think it's bad. You know, what's going on there, but, you know, I can, you know, at least if I'm there, you know, I'll be a little bit different. Not that they think they can change it, but, you know, I know, be someone who's not as shitty as the rest kind of deal. And I think most people end up getting burnt out and realizing that's kind of a little bit of a folly there, but they, you know, that's how a lot of people look at it. And I understand it. I'd be like, being a corrections officer is a little bit different than being like a legit cop or like something like that. So I don't really look down on people who do that. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I think that most of them end up being like, oh shit, I was wrong. I mean, I think, but, you know, I understand the reasoning. But yeah, let's get into what Mike revealed about what he thought, you know, Duncan was up to, which, you know, this is kind of, I guess, one of the bigger conspiracies it touches on, but it's not, there's only like a few minor semi confirmations out there. So it's like, we don't really know for sure, but it does have a lot of you know, implications of like a grander type conspiracy, possibly. Mm-hmm. So
when I reached out to Mike, he was in Ukraine. So I was thinking that, you know, when I reached out to him, that, you know, I was probably going to get like a FU, or I don't want to talk about it, or something of that nature. And so I just sent him a message explaining, like, hey, I'm writing a book on this topic. I see from this Alex Jones interview that you did a year or two prior that you said that you knew Duncan. Would you be willing to discuss that? And the first message I got back right away was a lengthy paragraph about how he knew Duncan, their interactions, that he believed that Duncan was murdered because of a Silk Road style program that he was designing for the militias in order to communicate amongst each other outside of the view of the government, and have some trade and transactions amongst themselves, again, out of the view of the government. And he believes that's why he was killed. Yeah. And that was the first response that I got. We had some longer, we had quite a long conversation that went on for a couple days through this chat, and while he was overseas, and revealed quite a bit. And there were some things that I asked him about that I kind of already had the answers to, and he just confirmed the information that I already had. I was trying to see whether or not what he was saying was legit. You know, there's also the other confirmation that I was able to find, aside from somebody who knew him, talked to him directly, was involved with him personally in business, no less, was the comments on Duncan's last post, which was a picture of a laptop screen with code on it and a pistol next to the laptop. And there was an individual who was, I want to say he was like a CFO or CEO of like some computer program company of some sort, was asking Duncan like what kind of projects are you working on lately. And Duncan, kind of in code, basically said the same thing that Mike Dunn was saying, was that he was working on a alternate, I wish I could remember the actual terms that he used. It was like an alternate market for the alt-right variety, using Binance and other programming. I can't remember all of it off the top of my head, but it was pretty much getting to the point of like almost exactly what Mike was describing. and seemed to be also in line with Duncan's ideas and what he was kind of tinkering around with at the time. Again, I don't know if working on a project like this is necessarily illegal. I don't know that the government would have any proof other than a simple comment on Instagram would be enough to justify. I could see it starting an investigation, but going to a guy's house in the middle of the night and just shooting him over some comment where, I don't know. I kind of looked at it at first. I found it before I talked to Mike Dunn. And at first I kind of got the impression that maybe he was just trying to impress this guy. Cause I looked at the other guy's Instagram account and was looking into his history, and it was like, he was kind of a big deal for that industry. And, you know, if Duncan wanted to impress somebody, you know, that'd be one way of doing it. But then again, I'm kind of thinking that maybe he was just being honest and almost bragging in an indirect way, thinking that, you know, if he said it in a certain way, nobody else would understand what the heck he was saying. But then again, can't ask him. We don't know.
Yeah.
We just have the comments sitting there online still. So,
yeah. Well, for context, we mentioned Silk Road. I don't know if we've mentioned this series, elaborate on what Silk Road was, or I guess not is. I was about to say is, but I don't think it exists in it at all anymore. I think once you understand what Silk Road is, it will make you understand why this was such a big deal. And on the legality aspect, I mean, what Ross Ulbricht did with the Silk Road was absolutely, you know, definitely probably illegal. you know, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm an anarchist. I think there was nothing wrong with what he did. I know a lot of people think that there might have been like the big aspect of that whole thing was that, you know, supposedly he was putting out hits on people with it. I've gone on a little bit deep dives. I've forgotten way more than I remember about it. I was never really convinced that was actually legit. It just seemed to be something the feds were trying to hem him up on so they can get him. But the Silk Road was clearly something they felt threatened by, and it was a very much demonstrated the use of cryptocurrency and what a threat it is to the government. And you know, also kind of showed the multiple uses of it, you know, of crypto. It's more than just, you know, money, because I think they were able to, I don't know, I might be wrong. I don't know if crypto was entirely, or not crypto, but Silk Road was entirely like a,
I think it was just Bitcoin. I think it was completely run on Bitcoin.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't know if, God, what's the technology Bitcoin uses? Well, I think it's crypto. No, God, I'm forgetting it. All the crypto people are probably mad at me, but there's a blockchain technology. That's one, because that's what is like essentially enables cryptocurrency, makes it basically unhackable, is the fact that it's run off of blockchain technology, which I couldn't really explain to people right now, but I'm not entirely sure if Silk Road ran off blockchain. I don't know if what Duncan was trying to do was going to run off of blockchain as well to kind of make it, you know, impenetrable by the government so they can't bring it down. But I'll give you a second if you can, you know, to let people know what the Silk Road was. I think most of my audience, like I said, probably know, but maybe not. Let's go over what Silk Road is, because I think once you have that context, it'll make you understand why it's such a big deal that maybe Duncan may have been, you know, looking into this sort of thing.
So the Silk Road was a dark web internet alternative for a marketplace, but outside of the government's eye, outside of Google, a lot of the Alphabet corporations and agencies. It was basically like a hidden underground website where people could use Bitcoin to trade for anything that they wanted. It was almost like an eBay marketplace, but Bitcoin was the only form of currency that was used. There wasn't any regulations. As for what could be traded, it could be a classic car. It could be a ball of cocaine. people were trading drugs, among other things, on the Silk Road. But it also had other features too. Like there were chat rooms. There was a book club. And being an anarchist, some of the books that were used for the book club, their copyright, there was copyright infringement going on, including the Anarchist Cookbook. I never quite understood the whole copyright thing when it came to the Anarchist Cookbook. It seems counterintuitive, but then again, you know, that was one of the books that was in the book club. But there was a few others where people were mad that their book was being traded for free on there. But there was a lot of other features that were on this website. But Bitcoin was the primary currency. It was basically the illegal activity of like the drug trade. I believe there might have been prostitution and a few other things going on of that nature. But the guy who created it was also accused of trying to hire like 5 different hitmen or something. But then again, all those charges were dropped. So for such a serious crime that they really wanted to nail him for them to just drop the charges kind of tells me that it was just one of those things they made up trying to get him to plea bargain, you know, for a lower charge. Yeah, it was definitely, I remember when that happened with the investigation and the arrest and everything. And, you know, they're talking about the Silk Road and, on the news, and it was definitely this was what, 2014? It was not long after like Michael Hastings and Edward Snowden. So they were like really trying to crack down on the internet at that time with a lot of the leaks and everything that were happening at that point.
Yeah. One aspect of this Silk Road and what Duncan was possibly may have been getting into, I do think it's important to note one thing this would do, because he was kind of trying to make this like an organizing thing for like militia type people. One thing this would do would give them a platform that wasn't infiltrated by feds, because maybe we've talked about this before. I've definitely talked about it on other shows. It's pretty well known. I definitely talked about on the Michigan kidnapping stuff I've done. The special like Facebook is infiltrated through and through. It's basically, you know, hand in pocket with the government. So the thing, the aspect of creating something like this would give them something like, yeah, I'm sure they could spy on it. They could get in there. They could have their people in there, but they wouldn't be able to infiltrate it to the extent they've infiltrated things like Facebook, to where they literally are able to access like private messages and stuff like that on a whim without having to put forth any effort whatsoever. So I do think that's something interesting to note, especially considering that's one of the big downfalls of militias. They get infiltrated by feds. They don't really have a place, you know, like that's like decentralized that they can interact in. You brought up Duncan's admissions on working in this. Wasn't there was also like an exchange with his mother that kind of implied that, right? I don't know if you recall that. I mean, implies it.
Yeah, it was. It was a series of text messages between him and his mom. Where, oh man, I'm trying to remember that how the conversation worked out without looking at it, but she was showing concern about what was going on at home, and he kind of shifted the subject over to his guns. And she was implying that she wanted him to like have whatever it is that he was doing elsewhere outside of the house, that she didn't want the family to be implicated in what he was doing. And he did make a comment about how like they're not coming after my guns or coming after my ideas, I've got the whole series of text messages in the book.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to go to it right now.
And it was recorded in the final police report the December 31st, 2020 report that was put out. But it definitely, like, he was trying to make the conversation about something else, and his mom was really pushing it back to what she wanted to talk about. And finally he was just like, you know, let's discuss this at home. But yeah, she was worried about whatever it is that he was working on, that the rest of the family is going to be implicated in it. And that doesn't sound like it's him legally owning firearms. It definitely sounds like something else that was going on, that either she got whim of it or he had mentioned it. Maybe she had seen this behavior before and kind of knew that he was up to something. Who knows? But yeah, there was that conversation, and there was the other conversation about wanting to get something on the door. There's definitely a series of conversations between him and his mom about security and things going on at the house, to the point where whatever it is that he was working on, she wanted it to be somewhere else. He wanted more security, and both of their concerns were definitely merited with what had happened in the end.
Oh, for sure. One other thing that I do think implies this is the aspect of the cop search. I think you know what I'm getting at. Kind of the all the things they went through, how the extent to which they tore apart everything. I'll let you go. I think, yeah, I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. But yeah.
Okay, so the raid takes place. Duncan is shot. He's on the floor, bleeding to death. The police go through the house. They secure the rest of the family members, handcuffing them, making sure they can't go anywhere, destroy any evidence. And even though the warrant was for this rifle, it only stated the rifle, didn't say anything else about any other kind of investigations going on, they proceeded to tear apart Casey Robinson's car. They took her laptop, her cell phone. They took Duncan's laptop, notebook, cell phone, 3D printer, a drill press, all of his firearms, the bulletproof vest, the ammo that he had. But yeah, all the electronic equipment that was in the house went with the police. Even though the warrant was for the rifle, the arrest warrant was because he had this rifle. The other thing that was revealed in the interview that you had with Casey is the questions that they proceeded to barrage her with right after the shooting was who he hang out with. How long did he have these ideas? Did you know that he was involved in this kind of stuff? What was he planning to do with it? None of it had anything to do with the fact that he had allegedly a felony as a minor or was in possession of a rifle they believed to be illegal. It all had to do with domestic terrorism bullshit. So the justification for the warrant was complete BS to begin with. This is where I would get into the confidential source that originally contacted the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department, which I believe to be the Department of Homeland Security. They were the only alphabet agency that was really focusing on this at the time. The FBI is now doing it, but this came post January 6th. As one agent recently put it, they have more agents looking for domestic terrorists than actually exist. That was a comment that came out a couple weeks ago, because the Biden administration has this number of terrorists that they want found, and the FBI is like, we can't give you what doesn't exist. But Department of Homeland Security, through statements by the head Mayorkas, he himself has stated that for the last couple years, they've solely focused on domestic terrorism or domestic violent extremists is what they like to call them, DVEs, where they create these files. They go through all these different websites to find out what different accounts that they have. They look at the activity, the comments, who they're connected with. And so there's this whole web that they have created where they just open files on individuals that leads to other people. They open files on them. And then when there's a bit of information where they think that they have enough to send to state, county, or local police departments, they forward it to them. And they say, this is what we have. We'd like you to investigate if possible. They'll give suggestions as to how they can get a warrant with the information that they have, even though it was all collected without a warrant. All the information that's handed off to these police departments is completely illegal. That's why when they do arrest people, the first thing that they'll do is they'll grab the cell phone or any computer. And then because of the raid, they'll get a warrant on that, collect information they already have so that they can integrate that into the report to justify the raid or the search that they just did. They even have classes on this that they do with local police departments where they say, if we give you this information, you can't use it. But once you do what we tell you to, you can then backtrack and then add that information back in because now you legally have accessed it.
Yeah.
And it's complete bullshit. It's been going on for years. There was a couple cases of drug dealers who ended up being released because they were able to find out through going to trial, because, you know, usually they'd like to have these plea bargains. Well, then you go to trial, then you are able to access the information that the police had on you in order to have your build your case, your defense. And then all of a sudden it's revealed, like, you got this information illegally. Like, you had no business being in my house. And next, you know, all the charges are dropped and they're found not guilty. And so this stuff has been coming out. They don't like the fact that it's being revealed or coming out, but yeah, this has been going on for a long time now. And it's only getting worse. And it's why we have so many FBI whistleblowers coming out now.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy. You look at Duncan, and when you kill someone, you don't have that that hazard of it going to trial and things coming out. Now, when you have something like the Michigan thing, the Michigan kidnapping thing, and those guys actually said, "Fuck you, we're not taking plea deals." I think two of them took plea deals, but there were a bunch of them, and most of them didn't. And surprisingly, a few of them actually got off. And a lot of people, you know, if you're standard normie, would probably be like, oh, well, only two of them got off and the rest got convicted guilty of this and that. We'll see that as a proof that they did it. But, you know, if anything, it's actually the opposite. The fact that two of them were got off, I actually think that more heavily implies it was complete bullshit, because of the fact that, like, if you look at the conviction rates of these things, it's super high. But the fact they actually took it and didn't take the plea deal like most people do, it's more stuff got to come out and more stuff got revealed in discovery that, you know, makes it look like, whoa, what the hell is going on here? Which likely would have been the case with Duncan as well. I believe we did touch on this aspect a little bit in the last episode, the fact that the feds will do this and then you have to, like, backtrack and get your stuff later. So all you got to do is have that one original thing that's decent enough to get the warrant, and then you can just find it later. I believe you also said in your book, too, that they did an electronic sweep of some sort where they were, like, looking for electronics all through the house, you know, which, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I could have swore I remember you said something like that in the book. Maybe I'm wrong. I think maybe I'm wrong. I might have read that wrong. But I was going to – all right. I think I might be wrong, judging by looking in my face. I could skim through the book.
They did search through the house. Like, well, one thing I pointed out was – before EMTs were even allowed in the house, the police were searching the house for all the evidence that they were trying to collect before they even allowed anybody to try to help Duncan. They were more concerned about securing all the evidence that they were looking for. They're more concerned about that than they were helping the person that they had just shot. So I felt like that kind of showed the importance of what it is that they were going after. Like, I don't even think necessarily looking back on it, that it was Duncan that they were really after. I think it was the information that he might have had, especially with the groups that he was working with, because he built websites for the Virginia Knights, the Boogaloo Boys, what was it, the State of Appalachia. That was another militia group that he had worked with, and those are the ones I was able to find. I don't know what other websites he worked on. All the ones that he built are gone now. They don't exist anymore. But yeah, I think it was more like the contacts that he had and the stuff that he was working on. I think they were more interested in the computer than they were about him.
It just makes it convenient when he dies so they don't have to deal with all the other stuff that might get in their way with that.
Right. Yeah.
I do want to emphasize too, because this does sound like we're being a little bit kooky and being like, oh, he may have gotten murdered, or, you know, or they botched a raid all in the hopes of stringing this guy up, for this. Like, it kind of sounds like kook shit. But if you understand, you know, we brought up Ulbricht already. You look at Assange. I think you mentioned as well. I had never heard of this Aaron Swartz guy, but I believe the Reddit guy.
Yeah.
They basically, the feds have tried, basically drove Aaron Swartz to, you know, essentially, you know, kill himself with the position they put him in. Assange, they've been trying to get him to do that for forever. Basically, they've admitted to it. Ulbricht, they just, you know, locked him up and threw away the key. And, you know, Duncan, it's really not that uncommon once you start digging into this, like, parapolitics type, you know, conspiracy type stuff. And I'm not gonna say conspiracy disparagingly, because a lot of this stuff is just confirmed stuff, is straight up confirmed. But there are so many cases of where the feds will use methods to essentially ruin someone and essentially drive them to, what was it? MLK. I think the feds were sending his wife recordings of it, cheating on her. And they were like messaging him frequently, tell him to go kill himself and stuff. Yep. So like, yeah, this isn't anything new whatsoever, but Duncan, that wasn't going to work. Duncan was like about to be a dad. He had a girlfriend that he really liked. They were looking at homes, like they were about to start a life. They were, you know, what is like their mid to early 20s. Like, well, things were going well, you know?
And they were looking at buying a house in a different state where the law that they used for the warrant wouldn't apply. So who knows what the timeline was on that. But if they knew that they were looking for a house and looking for it in another state out of their jurisdiction, that, that could have been the other reason why there was such haste on doing such a raid. Because otherwise, what other excuse would they have?
Yeah. All right. Let's get to the main thing. I want to know what you think, after digging through all this information, what do you think really happened in the raid? Because there's multiple different versions of this, of the take. So I wanted to kind of quickly just get what you think happened. And yeah.
So what I was able to piece together from the interviews and the reports, I pretty much discredited the first two news releases that the police put out. They contradicted each other. The third report, the final one that came out, which also had Casey Robinson's alleged testimony at the grand jury, and her interview on your show, I was able to kind of piece those together. There was, I believe, purposely left out information from the police side, even though they contradict themselves in a few different sections of that report. Casey's really doesn't change all that much. I believe hers is a little more, even with the state of confusion that she was in, the fact that there was two flashbang grenades that were found in the bedroom, there was the broken window, Duncan was shot, there was the fact that Duncan's body was found against the French doors going into leading into the house. So what I believe is the SWAT team for whatever reason, and it still doesn't make any sense to me other than it was a hit, split up their team into two. You have your main team going through the front door, and then you had a secondary team of two guys going outside Duncan's bedroom window. The reason they used the window is because the creepy guy who showed up the evening before was an informant who was sent in order to get a layout, find out if there's any type of booby traps, where people slept, house activity, where the weapons were, all that kind of information. It's common tactic that SWAT teams use before they do a raid. And the closer that they can get somebody in to the time that they're going to do the raid, the better, because the information is more accurate and it's less likely to change. So they know that there's a booby trap on the door, which otherwise, because Duncan was the subject of the warrant, they would have just gone in through that door and secured him, secured everything else that they wanted, and he'd still be alive today. Then, let's see here. So at the same time, the main team and the secondary team, they bash in the door, the front door of the house, with a battering ram, and they smash the windows to the bedroom. They throw in flashbang grenades. Flashbang grenades serve the purpose of causing a state of panic and confusion. So family has no idea what's going on. Everything is chaos. What is all this noise? At that time, Casey goes on to Duncan's side of the bed, is trying to hide under the bed. All she hears is glass explosions. There's people. Can't figure out what they're saying, because a side effect of a flashbang is that it causes temporary deafness. If you see it when it goes off, it causes temporary blindness, a state of panic, and a state of confusion. Fight or flight is what it does. Meanwhile, Duncan gets up, has no idea what the heck is going on, can't respond to the police commands because he's deaf. All he's hearing is a ringing in his ears, like he's just been to a rock concert for the last 3 hours. So all he's hearing is muffled sounds, a ringing tone. He doesn't respond the way that the cops want him to. He ends up being shot. After he's shot, he falls against the French doors. The police, who went in through the front door, go through the house, through the kitchen, go to the French doors. They can't get it open. They assume that he's blocking the doors. They're able to get the door open enough to throw in a flashbang grenade, which again is not part of procedure because the other two officers at the window are supposed to access the room through the window, allegedly. How you would do that, I don't know. But they did. They threw in the second flashbang grenade. Afterwards, they access the room. They find Duncan bleeding on the floor. They secure Casey on the floor in broken glass. They handcuff her. And this is after she tells him that she's pregnant. They disconnect the flashbang, the booby trap on the bedroom door that accesses the outside of the house. And they go around securing the rest of the house while Duncan is still bleeding on the floor. And they collect all the... Here's the other thing. They collect all the evidence that they wanted before they even turn on the body cams, because everything is placed exactly where they wanted it to be when the officer went through and made three videos recording what the house looked like. But I believe from what I saw in the videos and all the interviews, that's like the summary of what happened that night. But the thing with the police report is they completely leave out the fact that a flashbang grenade causes deafness. And their main excuse for shooting Duncan is he refused to follow commands of an officer. And the other thing is, when you use weapons like this, and it is a weapon, a flashbang is a weapon. They tried to make this argument after Waco that a flashbang was like a harmless thing. But they know what it is. They know what it's capable of doing. If you were to pull the pen and just hold it in your hand, you're not going to have a good day. Mm-hmm. They know what the side effects are. And as somebody who went to school for law enforcement for a short period of time, you're required to experience these things before you use them. So you know what the side effects are. Like, you can't use pepper spray. You're not allowed to carry pepper spray for most law enforcement departments unless you have it used on yourself, because you're less likely to use it on somebody else because you know what that experience is like. You're required to be tasered before you can carry a taser. So you know what it's like to be tased. It's not a funny toy. So they know what being affected by a flashbang is like, and they purposely left out that side effect from the report.
Yeah. A lot of people may not see it like this. They don't. I genuinely see flashbangs as essentially shooting first in a way. You essentially assaulted an individual unprovoked. I know there's a famous example a lot of people point to, which I can't remember if they killed the kid or if it was like severely fucked up for life, but I believe that actually killed it. There was an example of a time where the cops for some reason threw in a flashbang and it landed in a crib, and I think it killed the baby, I believe. So they're basically little mini grenades. Had they thrown it and say, they didn't throw it exactly they wanted to, and it landed right in the bed with him and Casey, it could have, caused serious harm. And really, I know it's a little bit arbitrary, but the deafness and the blindness, I think that can kind of qualify as assault to me. You probably could cause some sort of, lasting hearing damage from that. So to me, that's essentially no different than shooting first. So that's basically murder at that point, in my opinion. You cause the situation, and it caused it to escalate where it's at. Let's wrap up. I'm going to bring up, I just want to kind of cover quickly. I'll just do it myself. And if you have anything to add, you can. Just the aftermath of where we're at with after this. You have Casey. After the fact, she had something like a year. She didn't have her computer. I believe they took her car. So she basically was, it completely affected her income for a long time. Obviously, she didn't have that second income of her boyfriend, who was supposed to be the father of her, was the father of her child, and obviously was helping out. You have Ryan that now doesn't have the Ryan, Lemp, the son, who doesn't have a father anymore. You have the investigation still ongoing. The lawsuit. It's it will probably drag on for years. And the family was intimidated out of protest, which I believe we've covered all this before. So I'm kind of going through it. I just want to reemphasize the effects of something this has and the injustice that occurs. And then I think the one gleaming, I guess maybe, good side of this somewhat, if you could call it that, is it kind of made Duncan a martyr. And, they've admitted that with their, using him as a symbol of DVEs, as they say, and I think that's one of the few good things about this. I mean, obviously, I wish this never had happened, but if we're going to glean anything good out of it, is now we have this example to point to of Duncan and, what they're willing to do and all the fuckery involved. I really think everyone out there should – whether it's sharing this or buying the book or what have you, I think we should, make a point to continue this story. Because I do think the Lemp story is one of those, it's a modern event that happened. It's a very easy thing to point to of the overreach of government, if you will, in multiple different ways. So I commend you for writing a book. I believe, we've said before, this is the first book of its kind. I do think it's written in a way that it's good for people who we're semi-familiar with it, want to really dig deeper, or someone who's never heard of it before. It's not a super long book. It's also not super short. So I feel like it was just the right length to where it covers the stuff you need to know. And it also delves into the different aspects, the topics, maybe some people might think that's meandering, but I do think it's important to point out the history of the militia movement and stuff like that, like we have here in this. So I really hope everyone got something, that watched this got something out of it. Maybe share it around to someone who's interested in this. Or if you want a shorter one, like I said earlier, Matthew was on with Keith Knight, a Libertarian Institute. on their show. So maybe if you just want to give someone a quick little like to get their to pique their interest, I highly suggest that. I do see JC, you sent me $5 super sticker. Appreciate it, bud. Yeah, do you have any other parting words before we do plugs and get out of here?
My key piece of advice that I came up with on Keith's podcast was be very careful about what you post on the internet. That's and you know, I like to be a free speech absolutist. I think, you know, whether you're talking crap or cracking a joke, I think you have that right. I think the First Amendment is pretty darn important enough to where they also added the second one right afterwards to kind of protect it. But in this day and age, when we've got these alphabet agencies that are just bored out of their mind and they can't find any bad guys anywhere else, they're now looking at home, and you say the wrong thing at the wrong place. And it's just, it's insane the amount of laws that have been passed, and the fact that we no longer have we don't have due process anymore. Like, we still have January 6 people who are in solitary confinement and they still haven't been charged. And this is the kind of stuff that they're now gravitating into. Like, all the Abu Ghraib stuff that we saw with Iraq is now happening here. Yeah. And this is the type of thing that everybody should be concerned about. This is when I'm seeing these news articles where it's like Congress is going after, what was it, Ticketmaster? I'm like, that's your concern, Ticketmaster. Like, you're really pissed off about how much those Taylor Swift tickets cost, right? No, that should, like, what we're experiencing since 2020, 2021, that should be the number one concern everywhere right now. Like, people are pissed off about Elon Musk, and now you can say the N-word on Twitter. You say the wrong thing on Twitter and you've got a file opened on you, and that thing's not going to close until they find something to send an officer to your house with a warrant and snag your ass. That's kind of where we're at these days. So unfortunately, I think Duncan was really smart, like insanely smart, but he was also 21, posted something that he shouldn't have posted, probably was safe up until that point, but I just be very careful about what you post online these days. Like, I like to be a smart ass on Twitter, and half the time I'm like double, you know, questioning myself, like, do I really want to have this snarky remark out there, because it might bite me in the ass later.
Yeah. Fun fact, you brought the January 6th thing. I don't know if you heard about this, but recently they admitted, I think they said there was at least 8 informants, I believe specifically in the Proud Boys at January 6th. So they've admitted to that. We already knew it because, you know, there were a whole, what was his name? Ray Epps or Mike Epps. I know one of them's the actor. One of them's the guy. I always mix up the two. But I know everyone was pointed at that, and then they've straight up admitted to it. So it's their backtracking. I think I might try to do an episode. I have someone I might want to talk to about that. My strike just expired on this channel, so now we can start talking about a little bit more contentious stuff like January 6th. So Ray Epps, yeah, JC just corrected me in the chat. But it's funny how the backtracking works, and now it's just, there were no informants, or we're not going to tell you about informants. Oh no, there were informants, but there's been no evidence to suggest they did anything to, you know, aggravate the situation. And if anything, their focus now is, why didn't they pass on this information to their handlers about this happening? You know, like, and now that's the movement. So the backtracking works. And by the time, you know, we find out everything, it'll be, you know, probably 10 years from now, and, you know, it'll moved on, you know. So that's how these things work. Before we get out of here, JC says, thank you for the series. Great work from the both of you. I appreciate it. You want to go and drop your plugs, Matthew? Maybe bring up your book again and we'll get out of here.
Yeah, the book is A Crash in the Night, The Assassination of Duncan Lemp. You can find it ebook format and physical hard copy on Amazon. I also have the collapseexperiment.com, the Collapse Experiment podcast. I am currently on Twitter I'm trying to remember my handle name.
The Collapse Experiment. I don't know what your ad is though.
Something like that. Yeah. I think there's like a one at the end or something. And you can find me at Instagram, Matthew.Gilman, over there as well. And, that's about it.
Awesome. I appreciate your time. I'll probably have you on again to cover some other stuff. I know you wrote a book on the Michael Hastings one, so I think maybe one of these days I'll cover that. But yeah, this is the No Way Jose podcast. You can find me on YouTube, all the major auto podcatchers, Odyssey as well. Follow me on Twitter at SeniorJose2020 until I get my old accounts back. If you want to follow me on Facebook at Jose Galison, you can do that as well. If you want to support me, Patreon.com/NoWayJose2020. Like, share, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. And with that, we are out. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.